This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, President Bush nominated White House counsel Harriet Myers to replace Sandra Day O'Connor in the Supreme Court. If ratified, Myers would be the third woman to serve on the Supreme Court. She's also served in the Bush administration as Assistant to the President, Staff Secretary, and Deputy Chief of Staff. When he was governor, Bush appointed her chairwoman of the Texas Lottery Commission. In 1996, Myers became the first female head of her law firm, which then had about 200 lawyers. Earlier today, we called Cass Sunstein, a professor of law and political science at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk on the Supreme Court and has written extensively on issues of constitutional law. Sunstein's new book is called Radicals in Robes: Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America. Myers has never been a judge, and very little is known about her judicial philosophy and her positions on the controversial constitutional issues of our time. I asked Sunstein if it's unusual to have so little information on a nominee.
What makes this nomination really quite unusual is that in at least the last 20 years and probably more, we either know that the nominee is very qualified in terms of sheer ability, or we know something about the nominee's orientation to constitutional law, or both. This is doubly a stealth candidate. It's someone who doesn't have the record of demonstrated excellence that many recent appointees have had, including Chief Justice Roberts. And it's also someone who has a thinner record in terms of the great issues of the day than anyone really in memory. She hasn't been a judge, and so there isn't judicial product to evaluate, and that distinguishes her from most of the recent appointments. Not only that, she hasn't had Supreme Court experience, at least nothing substantial, so we don't know if she's experienced in the kind of litigation with which she'll have to deal. And also, she doesn't have any academic work that might show that she's thought in a sustained way about constitutional law. We do know she worked for a number of years on the Texas Lottery Commission, but that's not maybe the best background for the position of Supreme Court Justice. So there are a lot of gaps in her record compared to the recent appointees, which suggests she has a great deal to learn.
Now, it's interesting. The president must know where she stands on a lot of issues because she works so closely with him.
Yeah, the fact that this is has been a White House counsel, the president's personal lawyer, and someone who hasn't spoken publicly in any capacity on the most controversial legal issues really gives the White House a terrific advantage over the American public in terms of knowledge of where she stands.
And what does that mean, that they have the advantage over the American public
in terms of
knowledge of where she stands?
Yeah, it means that Democratic evaluation, and by Democratic I mean small d rather than capital D, is very difficult. So both conservatives and liberals should be puzzled by this, meaning puzzled about where the candidate stands on legal issues. So the advantage that the White House has over really everybody else is that no one can tell from the existing record where this person stands on issues of constitutional philosophy. So it would be surprising if conservatives are dancing in the streets with joy at this appointment. This is not someone who has a demonstrated record of conservatism. It would also be surprising if liberals are breathing a sigh of relief, or if liberals are lamenting it, because they just don't have enough of a record to know what to go on.
Now, some Democrats felt that John Roberts didn't have enough of a clear track record on the most important judicial issues and constitutional issues of our time. And he managed to get through the hearings and get confirmed without directly addressing several of those main issues. So if you look at how the Roberts confirmation played out, and then try to extrapolate from that to the Myers confirmation, what do you see in terms of the ability of Democrats or Republicans to elicit from her where she stands on issues?
The Democrats and Republicans actually learned a lot about Chief Justice Roberts. They read his opinions, and there were over 50 opinions for them to read, and they could tell from the opinions that he is meticulous, careful, someone who doesn't have his ideology in the forefront. So his judicial opinions were judicious, and that told him something. They also had, the Democrats and the Republicans, an extended record in which he talked a fair bit about constitutional issues. He also was forthcoming, more forthcoming than might have been expected, on some key matters. He said he believed there was a general right of privacy in the Constitution. He disassociated himself from the Scalia-Thomas view that the Constitution means exactly what the ratifiers believed it meant. He suggested a kind of moderation with respect to precedent that made at least some Democrats comfortable. So there was a record there, not as extensive as in the case of Judge Bork or Justice Ginsburg, but there was a record there. What makes this case quite different is there isn't the kind of public documentation that Judge Roberts had, and there isn't the kind of comfort that could come from reading a set of opinions, as Judge Roberts had, that showed this is a quite judicious person. Also, we shouldn't underrate, in the Roberts case, the powerful impact of sheer excellence. So a number of Democrats, as well as most Republicans, and many millions of Americans could tell this is someone who really knows what he's doing. To read Judge Roberts was to see this is someone with a first-rate mind. To hear him is to see this is someone with a first-rate mind. Now, it may be that Ms. Myers is similarly excellent, but she doesn't have the kind of background that demonstrates that excellence that Judge Roberts had.
What are some of the first questions you'd want to ask if you were on the Judiciary Committee?
Well, there's such a gap there. I think the first question to ask is, do you believe the Constitution means what it meant at the time it was ratified? To see whether she has that view associated with Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia. A second question is to ask, do you believe that there's a general right of privacy in the Constitution? I think a third set of questions would have to do with the president's power in domestic and international affairs. Many people were concerned about Judge Roberts that he'd had such extensive experience in the executive branch that in connection with the war on terror, in issues involving internal security, Judge Roberts would bend a bit in the president's favor. And that made members of Congress of both parties nervous, not just with respect to privacy, but also with respect to separation of powers. Ms. Myers has similarly had executive branch experience and more recently close to the sitting president. So the nervousness might be that on executive power, she would be very pro-president. You want to ask a bunch of questions about that. But we have to keep in mind with any confirmation hearing, there's a limit to how much you can really learn because the person is so well-schooled and is really running, in a sense, for the office. So with Judge Roberts, it wasn't just that he performed sensationally well in the hearings. It's also that as judge, there was a record of both excellence and meticulousness that provides some assurance. So you do want to ask her a bunch of questions about privacy, constitutional method, the power of the president, some questions maybe about equality, too. But it's not clear that they can get enough from that to make a full evaluation, even if she's reasonably forthcoming, because she doesn't have a public record to study.
Right after President Bush announced her nomination, Harriet Myers spoke briefly, and in her comment she said, "It is the responsibility of every generation to be true to the founder's vision of the proper role of the courts in our society." Do you read anything into that?
Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, the view that the founders should be followed in all particulars, that's a red flag. The founders believed in slavery. At least the Constitution accepted slavery. The founders certainly permitted awful forms of race and sex discrimination. They had a much narrower view of free speech and freedom of religion than we now do. The founders didn't apply the Constitution to state governments at all. Now, I'm sure she understands that the Constitution was amended, most important after the Civil War, in a way that greatly expanded our rights. But if the Civil War amendments are considered a second founding, as some people consider them, then even since then we've expanded our rights. The founders of the Civil War amendments, that is the people responsible for them, didn't intend to ban sex discrimination, and our Constitution now bans sex discrimination. And there's a good argument that they didn't intend to separate church and state with respect to states. That is, there's a good argument that in 1900 or 1890, Utah could establish an official religion, and so too for Massachusetts or Illinois or California. But we've gone beyond that through interpretation. So our tradition has been faithful to the text of the Constitution, but not faithful always to the particular views of the people who produce that text. And that's good. So when she talks about the founder's vision, she seems to be speaking of a constitutional approach that has been discredited. It's not clear that she endorses that approach to constitutional interpretation. That is the view that we should go into a time machine and ask what the founder specifically thought. But she does need to be asked about that.
Harriet Meyer's work in the past few years has been working with President Bush in the White House in one capacity or another. Can President Bush and Harriet Meyer's invoke the attorney-client privilege to say, well, no, we cannot turn over any of her papers since she started working in the White House?
No question. The president can invoke attorney-client privilege. In fact, he can go further than that. He can invoke executive privilege, which is constitutionally protected, to say that his private communications with his lawyer are something that no one has a right to. So the president stands on very strong ground in saying that this is not material that should be made public, if that's what the president chooses to say. Now, any privilege can be waived. So if the president thinks, some documents at least I want to make public as a way of giving some sense of what this person is like, the president can certainly do that. So insofar as the president wants to maintain confidentiality with legal advice from his own lawyer, he is on the firmest possible ground. On the other hand, members of the Senate can say, if we don't have that, we just don't have enough to go on. So they can say, in a way that is respectful of the president's constitutional prerogatives, we can't vote for her unless we see more. Now, it's possible that her quite interesting background in Texas and her recent work in the White House, combined with her dedication to public service, will convince many or most that there's enough there. This is obviously a dedicated public servant, someone who has devoted her life to thinking about law in multiple domains, and some people will think that's enough. But without demonstrated evidence that says something about her views of constitutional law, other people will be very nervous.
Cass Sunstein, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Radicals in Robes: Why Extreme Right-Wing Courts Are Wrong for America.